Brilliant. Adrian, thank you very much for reading. Just to introduce myself again, if we've not met, my name's Richard Dry. I'm a vicar in the Paddington area, and I used to work in finance for 15 years before that. Well, as we come to this passage, I just want to start by zoning in on those words at the beginning of chapter 14, where Jesus says, "Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me." I don't know how that strikes us. At one level, they're words of great hope, aren't we? That if we face trouble in life, there is great comfort to be found in holding on to our faith in the Lord Jesus. But I think it's probably also fair to say that when we find ourselves facing hard times, often what happens is that our horizons narrow. We can only see what is immediately in front of us, the problems before us. And actually in those moments, it's quite hard to keep a hold of our faith. And that seems to be something of what is happening to Jesus' disciples at this point in this reading. And they're troubled because Jesus has told them that he's going away and they're going to be left on their own. For the last 3 years, they've been with Jesus, they've been following him, they've set all their hopes on him. And now he just says, "I'm going to go away and you can't follow me." So I guess the emotions within the room on this night before Jesus died would have been that of sorrow, of fear, of confusion. I guess we might think perhaps as a time when maybe as a kid when we stayed away from home for the first time. And for a moment, the excitement gave way to homesickness. You know, that sinking feeling of just feeling very alone and anxious. And of course, it's not just kids on a trip away that feel that. We all know what it is to have that sense of loneliness and fearfulness and trouble. What does Jesus say to them? Well, he says these words, "Let not your hearts be troubled, believe." But believe what? I think what Jesus really wants them to grasp is that his going away is for their good. You know, right there they are, sat in that room, eating their supper, and they can't see beyond this immediate thing. They don't want Jesus to go. And what they need to grasp is that it's because Jesus will leave them that actually they'll be brought into the hope of heaven. They'll see the glory of God. What Jesus is doing here is really calling the disciples to lift their eyes from what's immediately before them and see the bigger picture of what he's doing as he goes to the cross the next day. And I think if that's the message for the disciples, it's the same for us today. I think Jesus is here calling us to raise our eyes and see the bigger picture of what he is doing in history. And last week, as we began this series, we said that the cross was central to our service of Jesus. I think this week we're going to see that it's central to our hope. And I've really got two big points I want us to grasp. And the first is the glory of the cross. If we wanted to go mining for diamonds, we would descend into the depths of the earth and sort of through the darkness in order to get there, to get to that sparklingness. Well, so we need to descend to the depths of the cross to see Jesus' glory. And you can see that really clearly here. Jesus used the words glory 5 times. This is the moment where we're going to see him glorified. Now, it's just worth saying, why do I think that this moment is the cross particularly that speaks of his glory rather than just the resurrection? Well, the he in verse 31, he's just gone out as Judas. It's Judas leaving to betray Jesus that makes Jesus say this. Throughout John's gospel, the hour of Jesus' glory is the hour of the cross. And in verse 38, Jesus will talk about laying down his life. So here it is. The cross is the moment when we'll see Jesus' glory. And that in itself is pretty counterinstinctive. If we were to play a game of word association with the word glory, I say the word glory to you, I guess we would think of splendor or majesty or achievement. If I say the word cross, what do we think? Well, we think of betrayal, of rejection, of condemnation, a man beaten and mocked and hung up until the life has bled out of him. And yet Jesus says, this is the moment in which the Son of Man is glorified. Jesus' supreme glory is seen in his supreme suffering on the cross. How does that work? Well, it seems that as Jesus dies on the cross, we see the glory of both the Father and the Son. Jesus says, now as the Son of Man, that's Jesus glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself. So both the Father and the Son are glorified at the cross. Now, at one level, we see that because as we look at Jesus dying on the cross, we see his love, his compassion, his humility. If we're trusting in him, then he died on the cross, bearing the penalty for all our sin in our place. What extraordinary love. Also, as we look at the cross, we see the justice of the Father, that he won't ignore our sin. We'll then see the power of the Father as he raises Jesus from the dead. But I think what's particularly interesting here is that Jesus isn't just saying at the cross, the Father is glorified and the Son is glorified. He's saying that they each glorify each other. They give glory to each other through the cross, as if they're like two mirrors and the light is bouncing between them. And it may seem a bit nerdy, but I think it's just worth trying to pull out what's going on here. So how is it that God the Father is glorified in Jesus the Son? Well, I think because Jesus shows us the supreme revelation of God's character. You know, as we read through the Old Testament, we read time and time again that God is a God of love and compassion, of mercy, of justice. Well, how do I see that love and compassion in its ultimate form? Well, I see it as Jesus dies on the cross. If I want to see the character of the Father, I see it revealed supremely in Jesus' death on the cross. More than that, I see it in Jesus' obedience to the Father. This is a big theme in John's Gospel. I've got a friend of a friend who always said he found it a bit confusing that when a man proposes to a woman, he normally takes her to some flash restaurant or some big site somewhere and makes a big splash about it. And he always said, look, when I get married, I'm going to take my prospective wife-to-be to the dodgiest, most run-down restaurant in town. Because if she says yes then, well, then I'll know she's serious. You know, I guess the point is that we see the depths of someone's love in the depths to which it stoops. When we see the extent of Jesus' love for the Father, that he stoops to obedience of death on the cross. This is the ultimate praise that God is worthy of this obedience. How then is Jesus glorified by the Father? Well, because the Father delights in Jesus and he enthrones him. So as Jesus is raised up from the dead, we see the power of God raising him, but more than that, it's not just that Jesus has finished his work, it's that God is enthroning him and approving him. If I want to know what God approves of, then I see that approval in his approval of his love for his Son. So when Jesus says, let not your hearts be troubled, believe in me, believe also in God, what they need to believe is that it's for their good that Jesus is going away. In other words, Jesus going to the cross isn't just a slightly inconvenient or unfortunate path that Jesus must walk for this salvation thing to work out. It's the ultimate revelation of the glory of the Father and the Son. They've got to know Jesus on earth, but now they will see his glory so much more in so many different dimensions as he goes to the cross. So when Jesus goes to the cross the next day, the disciples will run away in fear. But in days to come, the nations will gather in worship. The crowds will shout in mockery, but in days to come, the nations will sing in praise. The leaders will condemn Jesus, but the nations will come to adore him. The soldiers will beat and torture Jesus until his body is lifeless, and God will raise him up such that every tongue confess that he is Lord. This is the hope of the glory of the cross. If only the disciples will lift their eyes and see what is about to happen. So Jesus is saying that he must go to the cross to show his glory. And that means that we must look to the cross to see the glory of God. I think we often try and seek God's glory in, I don't know, a beautiful piece of music or a beautiful piece of scenery or an impressive building or a piece of art. But Jesus would say we see God's glory supremely in the cross. If I feel remote to Jesus, if I feel cold in my faith, then I do well to dwell on the cross and see the different ways in which I see the glory of the Father and the Son together. The same is true as we seek to declare the glory of God. If I'm trying to speak to my colleagues and friends about my faith, there's all sorts of ways I can do it. I can try and establish the intellectual credibility of the Christian faith. I can argue that the Christian faith is a force for good. I can try and sweep away some of their misconceptions. But ultimately, I need to point people to the cross, because that is where ultimately they will see that the Christian faith is a glorious truth. When I was growing up, I had a friend who used to say that 9 out of 10 questions that people ask about the Christian faith can be brought back to the cross. And it is here that is the power for people to see God's glory. If we're on the call today looking into the Christian faith, then the cross is right at the heart of Christian hope, because it's on the cross that we see that through faith we can have our sins forgiven and we can be invited, if you like, into that eternal love that the Father has for the Son, and we get drawn into it. What do these verses say to us when we're troubled? Let not your hearts be troubled, believe in God. Well, it's a call to believe that our God is the kind of God who brings glory out of darkness. That our God is a God of love and of justice, of power. When we're tired of the injustice and the harshness and the coldness of this world, when we long for compassion, well, here is the hope. As Jesus lifts our eyes to see the love and compassion and the glory of God as we see it on the cross. So that is one big thing I want us to see from this passage, that it's at the cross that we see God's glory. I just want to highlight two things quickly in passing before coming on to the second big thing. The first is that we also see here the love of the cross. So Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you're to love one another. By this people will all people know you're my disciples, if you have love for one another." We mentioned this last week, and it's as if Jesus starts to talk about this, and then Peter interrupts him, and so he comes back to it in chapter 15. So we'll talk more about this in chapter 15. I just want to flag it now. And the particular thing I want to flag is that that word new, in what way is this a new commandment? Well, throughout the Old Testament, we're told to love one another. But I think what's new here is the extent of love, the standard of love that Jesus shows us on the cross. We might think about, I don't know, in the history of music, there have been one or two pivotal moments, haven't they? The opening chord of Beethoven's Third Symphony, or Elvis walking into a recording studio. Music already existed, but they took it to a new level. Well, throughout the scriptures, there's this command to love each other, but Jesus takes it to a new level when he died on the cross. And again, it's a call to lift our eyes and see what is going on here. You know, we live in a culture that prizes love, that speaks much of love. But as we look to the cross, we see the ultimate love of the Lord Jesus. When we're troubled by this, the lack of love and compassion in our culture, well, here is the ultimate love. That's the love of the cross. And we'll come back to that later on in this series. Another thing I just wanted to quickly highlight before we move on is the unique work of the cross. So Simon Peter says to Jesus, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus answers him, "Where I'm going, you cannot follow me now, but you'll follow afterwards." And Peter said to him, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I'll lay down my life for you." You can picture the scene, can't you? Peter, always the activist. And he says, "Look, I'm going to come with you now. I want to stand up. I want to be counted." And Jesus says, "You can't. You can't follow me." This takes us back to what we saw last week, that before we serve Jesus, we must be served by him through his death at the cross. In other words, the work of the cross is unique. The hope is not in us. We're not the Messiah. I think many of us are the kind of people who think if we hit a problem, we'll work our way out of it. But the reality is that so many of the things that trouble us in life are because of sin. Sin in our hearts, sin in our world. And what Jesus is saying here is that to believe in him is to rest on his unique work of the cross. And again, that's an idea that will come up and again through these chapters. But listen, if the first big thing I want us to grasp this lunchtime is the glory of the cross, the next big thing I want us to see is the hope of the cross. Let's look at verse 1. Jesus says, "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again and take you to myself, that where I am, you may also be. Now there is hope for a restless soul. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you?" This is the hope of the cross. When I used to work in finance, we'd sometimes have these weeks where we would go on a road show around Europe, and you'd do like a night in Paris, then another night in Zurich, and then Milan or Geneva or whatever it was, you know, a different night in a different hotel every time. Sometimes the hotels would be pretty sterile. Sometimes they'd be quite nice, but you wouldn't get to stay there because the next morning would be up and off, living out of a suitcase. I don't know if you've had that experience. But then, of course, at the end of the week, when I came home, it was wonderful. If I was lucky, I'd get to fly over the Thames on the way in, and then I'd go down the steps into my flat. And, you know, it's the feeling of being at home, the smell of being at home. You don't really realize that your home has a smell to it until you've been away, and then you come home. And it's really that sense of home that Jesus is speaking about here. I go to prepare a place for you, not a hotel room, but a place where we belong. And the way that he prepares that place is through the cross and resurrection. By dying for our sin, that he might bring us home to be with God. So when Jesus says, "Let not your heart be troubled, believe in God, believe also in me," what are we to believe? Well, that actually this world is not our home. It's not the place where we belong. That has to come. So often we spend so much of our time in this world trying to make our home here. Maybe trying to improve our home physically, I don't know, a new kitchen or whatever it is. Maybe trying to improve our situation, the right job, the right schools for our kids, the right friendships groups. But there's so much that we can't control that is uncertain. Maybe we try and find that place of belonging in people by kind of trying to cultivate relationships that make us feel secure and treasured and appreciated. But of course we lose people and we can't control how people respond to us. Maybe we try and find that place of belonging within us, to find the real me, to express myself as I am. But of course, as I look within, we change. And sometimes when I look within myself, I see things that I don't like. Sometimes I'm conscious that the version of me that I'm projecting out isn't quite true to myself. This world is not our home. That is yet to come. Jesus is preparing it for us. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of living in a house where there's a room it's just a bit awkward. You know, it's the wrong shape, or it's always dark, or it's just a bit too small. It doesn't matter what colour you paint it, what configuration of furniture, you can't quite get it right. Well, so it is with our lives in this world. This is not our home. We'll never be fully comfortable here. Our home is yet to come. Jesus says, look, believe me. When we feel lonely and awkward and out of place and unsettled, there is a place where we truly belong. Jesus says, I'm going to prepare a place for you. Our home is in the future, and it is with Jesus. Do you notice the personal language that Jesus is using here? Look at it in verse 3. If I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again, and I'll take you to be with myself, that where I am, you may also be. That place that Jesus is preparing for us is with him. Do you notice how the house is described? Not as a big house or a magnificent house or a luxurious house, but my Father's house, with God. This is personal. We'll be with Jesus in God's house. We shouldn't think of heaven as being kind of like one of those five-star hotels where they have marble floors and cut glass wine glasses, and we're just slightly afraid that it will break something all the time. The glory of heaven is the glory of being with God. And remember, it's in God that we see glory and love and compassion. The Father who esteems servanthood. Now, there is hope in this harsh and uncaring world. And it is a place for us. If we're trusting in Jesus, he says to us today, I am preparing a place for you. When this world seems cold and people seem harsh and it's full of anger and finger pointing, there is a place for us with the glory and the love and the compassion of God. And notice that this promise is secure. Jesus says, if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back again and take you to be with myself. He's talking there about him coming back at the end of time. And he will return to take us personally to be with him. At this time, when everything is so uncertain and up in the air, Jesus is speaking here of preparing a place for us that is certain and secure. Well, we don't understand why God allows a particular thing to happen to us. Well, God hasn't lost the plot. Heaven is secure for God's people. I will come again and take you to be with myself. So Jesus says, let not your hearts be troubled, believe in God. Believe what? Well, that Jesus is preparing a place for us. Our place where we belong is not now, but it is with Jesus, and it is secure. So that is the hope of the cross. And these are really the two big themes that come through from this passage. The glory of the cross, Jesus must go so we see his glory, and the hope of the cross, he must go so that he'll prepare a place for us. Think back to the disciples now in that upper room before Jesus dies. There they are, and all they can see is their sorrow and sadness and loneliness that Jesus is leaving. And what he does to them is say, look, lift up your eyes and see what's happening. I must go, because when I go, well, then you'll see my glory on the cross, and you'll have that great hope of heaven to come. And so the call here, in the midst of all of that, is for them to believe in that glory and that hope. And I think the call for us this lunchtime is exactly the same. Whatever we're facing, that we lift our eyes and see Jesus' glory and see the hope that he brings through the cross.